God and the Skeptics. We looked at part one of seven of the greatest arguments that the skeptics come up with, why you shouldn't, why you cannot believe in God and the Bible and Christianity. We were showing that in each case, they were not sufficient reasons, and that there was an error in the very heart of it. For instance, when they were saying, how dare you be so arrogant as to say that you know the truth, when the real truth is, and then they would tell what they thought was the truth in all arrogance and so on. So in every case where they, everybody has what they consider to be the truth. And so to argue that we're somehow wrong for proclaiming what we believe is the truth is in itself self-contradictory. Well, in part two, we're looking at seven reasons for faith. And some of these are more or less some common arguments for the existence of God. This one is a little different. Timothy Keller's book, The Reason for God, is the basis of our what I'm following through, though I don't follow everything that he says. I find that the concept is very interesting. And he has a very successful church down in the heart of Manhattan in the middle of a liberal town, and has spent 20 years there ministering to people who were dyed-in-the-wool skeptics. But he's given me such an encouragement for the world in this book, because he's saying what he finds is that the people that he's dealing with are in themselves trying to be moral. They have a moral outrage about a number of things. And in many cases, they're tired of the old skepticism. You know, that's almost the breeding ground for revival. It's the point when paganism sounded so cute, so new, so interesting, until you get in it for a while. And then it's all fear and superstition, and people get tired of it pretty quick. Well, share with me then the problem of sin. And as I first opened up the book and was reading this, I had one idea of what he was going to say. Found it was another idea entirely. And I really like this idea. What I want you to take from this is understand what the unsaved is doing. Understand what they're doing more than they understand it. And then share with them that they have already accepted something or someone as Lord of their life. But their Lord isn't as good as our Lord. And in fact, at the very heart of their acceptance of something as Lord of their life, they are doomed to failure. They are doomed to become something they don't want to become. Notice with me, by way of introduction, a change of view experienced by H.G. Wells. I was just, I bought a DVD that had four old-time science fiction things on it, Forbidden Planet and 2001 Space Odyssey. Man, if you ever want to watch something that will put you to sleep, it is 2001 Space Odyssey. It is the slowest thing in the world. It's like intentionally being slow. And we've, you know, all the special effects have been seen over and over again now, so nothing so new that you're saying, wow, how can they do that? But the other one was Time Machine. Rod Taylor, I think, is the actor's name, and a classic Time Machine thing. And then I got to thinking about it. There's a modern one out that was very different. I've never read the thing. I found it online and read the book. And I found that essentially it was Wells thinking that we're after making things better, getting people more comfortable. And then he went, you know, a few hundred thousand years in the future, and he found that it had happened like that, and the people were all just kind of They're short and effeminate and happy, but mindless, and had no concept of reading, writing, or anything. And he says it's the natural thing because strength and division of duties and so on all come with need and so on. So it was kind of an interesting study in politics, actually. But I was fascinated to read this, that he wrote in 1937, A Short History of the World. Can we doubt that presently our race will more than realize our boldest imaginations, that it will achieve unity and peace, and that our children will live in a world made more splendid and lovely than any palace or garden that we know, going on from strength to strength in an ever-widening circle of achievement? He's saying, how could we, can we really doubt that? We see what's going on. Can we doubt that? Then he says, what man has done, the little triumphs of his present state, form but the prelude to the things that man has yet to do. Smiling into the future, Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek, this is, everything is evolving to the greatest possible thing. And then, 1946, end of World War II. The cold-blooded, his title, A Mind at the End of Its Tether, the cold-blooded massacres of the defenseless, the return of deliberate and organized torture, mental torment, and fear to a world from which such things had seemed, seemed well-nigh banished, has come near to breaking my spirit altogether. Homo sapiens, as he has been pleased to call himself, is played out. Boy, he's down, isn't he? He's down. He lost hope. There's a reason for that. In fact, the reason for his losing hope is found in that first quote, where he had put his hope, you see. Instead of losing hope, the doctrine of sin, even the fact of sin, can be an avenue of hope for the sinner. B.B. Taylor, in speaking of sin, the lost language of salvation, said this: neither the language of medicine nor law is adequate substitute for the language of sin. Contrary to the medical model, we, as sinners, we are not entirely at the mercy of our maladies. Medical model, the lady that Emily was talking about, just finds she has a disease. She didn't do anything to cause it, just has it. We're at the mercy of that. But not so with a sin. The choice is to enter into the process of repentance. There is always the cure with sin. Then, contrary to the legal model, the essence of sin is not primarily the violation of laws, but a wrecked relationship with God, with one another, with the whole created order. All sins are attempts to fill voids, wrote Simone Weil. Because we cannot stand the God-shaped hole inside of us, St. Augustine's term, we try stuffing it full of all sorts of things, but only God may fill it. Andrew Dabunko was researching Alcoholics Anonymous as a humanities professor at Columbia University. At one meeting that he was attending, a young man, all dressed up real sharp, complained about all the mistakes that he made due to injustice and betrayal by others. He went on in his wounded pride, and a black man in his 40s leans over to Andrew, and he said, I used to feel that way too, before I achieved low self-esteem. Before I achieved it, he said. I think it's interesting that when you realize how much having strong self-esteem has been built up today, how much this older black man understood that as long as he's standing there in pride, he's not getting it. So Andrew then wrote in the Real American Dream, a meditation on hope, "For me, it was the moment I understood in a new way the religion I had claimed to know something about. As the speaker bombarded us with phrases like, 'Got to take control of my life,' 'I've really got to believe in myself,' the man beside me took refuge in the old Calvinist doctrine that pride is the enemy of hope. What he meant by his joke about self-esteem was that he learned no one can save himself by dint of his own efforts. He thought the speaker was still lost, lost in himself, but without knowing it." Well, I'd like for you to consider with me one of the meanings of sin. And there are several ways that you can define this, but this is an interesting one, and one that I think will help you in dealing with other people about Christ. The meaning of sin. The Christian's doctrine of sin can be a great source for human hope. Sin is the despairing refusal to find your deepest identity in your relationship and service to God. We'll be emphasizing that. But sin, one of the characteristic things of sin, is the refusal to find your deepest identity in your relationship and service to God. Sin is seeking to gain your identity apart from Him. So I ask, what gives you your sense of identity? Are you distinct from others? Are you valuable? Why? This is the question that we want to probe into people's hearts. Everyone is working for self-worth, some meaning to their existence. What are they counting on? Soren Kierkegaard wrote Sickness Unto Death in 1849. He asserted that humans were made not only to believe in God in some general way, but also to love Him supremely, center their lives on Him above anything else, and build their very identities on Him. This is the key then, that this is how man was created. Any straying from this is sin. And we know that from 1 John 3, 4b, that sin is the transgression of the law. But look at what is the first of the Ten Commandments. Exodus 20, verse 3. "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." Making nothing else a god except God. Therefore, the very first way of defining sin, first in the Ten Commandments, is not the doing of bad things, though that would be a bad thing, but not so much doing of bad things, but making even good things ultimate in your life. If you make it ultimate in your life, you're making a god of it. And so let's look at sin as taking something in this life, something in the created world, elevating it to the ultimate, making this your, I pin my self-worth on this. This is going to prove, Rocky said, prove I ain't no bum, you know. This is to show that I have a meaning of my existence. When you make something other than God central to your significance, to your purpose, even to your happiness, you have violated the first commandment. What justifies your existence? Ernest Becker, in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Denial of Death, said that a child's need for self-worth is the condition for his life. He explains that whatever we use as the basis of our identity, of our self-worth, becomes our God, small g God. So what fulfills you? Is it love? Is it a career? If you say, if somebody says, what are you? You say, I am a banker. You see? That is your identity. That's your career. That's who you are. Becker concludes that setting these things up as God in your life leads to a continual disappointment. And here's what he has to say. No human relationship can bear this burden of godhood. If your partner is your all, then any shortcoming in him becomes a major threat to you. What is it that we want when we elevate the love partner to this position? We want to be rid of our feeling of nothingness, to know our existence has not been in vain. We want redemption, nothing less. Needless to say, humans cannot give this. Traditional cultures teach self-worth in fulfilling duties to family, being the mother, being the father, being the breadwinner. Every time I say that, I remember the time we were at a smorgasbord, and we saw an enormous man come in with a frail little wife. And I said, well, it looks like he's the breadwinner. And my wife said, and she's the bread loser. the traditional cultures emphasize that as your identity, service to the community. Modern cultures emphasize achievements, social status, talent, love relationships. These are the things that make the world go round. Everyone is building their identity on something. As you talk to someone, you get to know someone. Search in their life, what are they using to build their identity? Is that something on which you are building your life and identity worthy of that honor? Is that thing worthy of deity? Here's the questions for you to think about, and the different concepts for you to fill in if you have a pen or pencil. The various ways of looking at this. If you center your life, first of all, on your spouse or partner, if that is the actual center of your life, then what's the consequences? You become emotionally dependent, jealous, and controlling. The other person's problems will be overwhelming to you. You pinned your hope of self-worth on them. Any little tremble of the earthquake in this relationship and you're done for, you see. Secondly, if you center your life on your family and children, you live your life through your children until they resist you and resent you or accept your control and have no self of their own. You may abuse them when they displease you. I've seen women whose identity was wife. And when the husband died, they were lost. Their self was gone. When the children left the home, the woman who built her identity as mother was lost. Empty nest syndrome, nothing. This was the crumbling of deity. She poured herself daily into those children, and they just left. And it's a terrible, terrible life situation. Thirdly, if you center your life on your work and career, you become a driven workaholic and a boring, shallow person. At worst, you succeed in business and lose your family and friends, or fail in business and develop deep depression. Next, if you center your life on money and possessions, you become obsessive about money. You will choose to do unethical things to maintain your lifestyle, but it will blow up in your face. Having more, being like whatever Joneses you're looking at, never gives you what you hope. Next, if you center your life on pleasure or comfort, you become addicted to something. You are chained to escape strategies to avoid the hardness of life. I'm after comfort. I'm after pleasure. So I have to escape everything that brings hardness into my life. You can't stand up to that because that's not your deity. See?
You're living your life for the rest of your life.
That's right. Next, if you center your life on relationships and approval, having my friends, being approved by them, you become overly sensitive to criticism, and in doing that, you lose your friends. You will not be able to confront friends by saying they're doing something wrong, and so you become a useless friend. You're not somebody's best friend. You're useless, you know. You're the person who always says, okay, because you are submitting, you're sacrificing to your deity. Next, if you center your life on a noble cause, can you hear the echoing? A noble cause. You take one side so strongly that you divide the world into good and evil and demonize your opponents. Strangely, you are controlled by your enemies, because without them you have no purpose. You are the campaigner against those demon enemies. So you have to keep finding those enemies, even if you've fairly well successfully got rid of them. If you center your life on religion and morality, you may live up to your standards and become proud, self-righteous, even cruel. If you do not live up to your standards, you're overwhelmed with guilt. And then finally, if you center your life on your, you say, I'm not gonna worship happiness and anything. I'm free of that. I'm completely free. Well, maybe you're centering your life on your own independence and personal freedom. Then you become terrified of anything that threatens that freedom. Someone who says, I'll tell you what to do. The boss says, you have to do that. This isn't just inconvenience. This is terrifying because my God is my independence. Let's look then at the personal consequences of sin. Consequences to yourself. Recognize then, as we've just been pointing out, that identity apart from God is essentially unstable. Without God, your sense of worth may seem solid, but it never is. As we were just noting in all of these things you filled out, it can desert you in a moment. And this is terrifying, to have your God crumble before your very eyes. At that moment, this isn't just a difficulty, a bump in the road. You lose the self that you built. Your world crumbles. You become neurotically guilty because you failed in the very thing that gave you meaning. If a person causes this loss, if a person did that to you, you are locked into devastating bitterness against that person. But if you are the cause, you despise yourself the rest of your life. people who sense the frailty of their God and of their self-worth become hesitant to venture anything or to face anything. I don't think I can take that test. What if it doesn't work? I can't risk that kind of rejection, you see. If the transcendent God of the universe is your God, and your self-worth is based on the fact of his love to you, unrestricted, uncontrolled love to you. Not uncontrolled, what is the word I'm trying to say? Unconditional love to you. Then you can venture anything, you can face anything. What can stand up to God, you see? A life not centered on God leads to emptiness, and it hurts us if we don't get the desires of our heart. But it even hurts us if we do get the desires. Because if you chase that deity and get it, you find that it's empty, that you based your life on that. A lady columnist who knew many movie stars before they became famous there in New York said they all became more angry and unhappy after their success. You say, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. They were working as, you know, movie ticket salespeople, waitresses, and busboys. They gained the great success, lots of money, lots of fame, and they're more angry, more unhappy. She wrote this. That giant thing they were striving for, that fame thing that was going to make everything okay, that was going to make their lives bearable, that was going to fill them with ha-ha happiness, had happened. And the next day, they woke up, and they were still them. The disillusionment turned them howling and insufferable. Cynthia Heimel, Tongan Sheik column. Personal consequences. There are social consequences to this sin, to sin. H.G. Wells was terribly discouraged with the course of humanity. English writer Dorothy Sayers, anybody read Dorothy Sayers? Detective book. In her 1947 book, Creed or Chaos, recounted the disillusioned intellectual types in England in the aftermath of World War II. She attributed this to the fact that they, these intellectuals, had clung to the optimistic, the humanistic belief in man's ability to achieve progress and enlightenment, summarized by what H.G. Wells said first. She said that they had lost the sense of original sin, as the Bible teaches it, that mankind was, at the very core, self-centered and wicked. The horrible events of World War II negated everything they believed. They were completely disillusioned. She wrote this, she concluded, "The Christian dogma of the double nature in man, which asserts that man is disintegrated and necessarily imperfect in himself and all his works, yet closely related by a real unity of substance with an eternal perfection within and beyond him, makes the present powerless state of human society seem less hopeless and less irrational. If your deity said man is getting better and better and better, and then he does what was done in World War II, that deity has fallen." Jonathan Edwards wrote a wonderful study of the social consequences of sin, the nature of true virtue, and he said that human society is deeply fragmented when anything but God is our highest love. He says, if our highest goal in life is our family, we will tend to care less for other families. That has to make sense, right? If our highest goal is our nation, depending on the nation, we'll become racist or nationalistic. If our highest goal is personal happiness, we will put our own finances and power interests above those of others. Only if God is our God will our hearts be drawn out to people of other families, other races, other classes, other nations, the whole world. This is the only way that it works. And there is no way out of this dilemma. The more we love and identify with things other than God, the harder it is not to feel superior to and even hostile toward others. You put your family first, the other families, your family is better. And if that family gives you any problem, you have to be hostile to that family. Think about it then. Racism, classism, sexism, these all stem from choosing an identity that opposes one or more of these things. If my identity is maleness, then I must consider femaleness as inferior. There are cosmic consequences of sin. You know, the Bible's account of creation is very different from the ancient pagans, actually from the modern pagans as well. The Big Bang theory, violence started everything. Often the gods were in some sort of warfare or something, and often the creation of things happened by accident, or at least not with close intention. The Bible pictures a loving God building all of this for his own purposes. Can you picture it? Christ kneeling and gathering that red clay together, forming the body of man, reaching down, getting literally his hands dirty, and breathing into him the breath of life. This was an act of love. This was an act of creation for the purpose of loving fellowship. Then he takes him from where he created him, brings him into the Garden of Eden, and says, here's the home that I have for you. And everything is working. When he creates it, he looks around, he says, this is good. This is very good, you see. Everything was what? It was all working together. Everything was harmonious. The Hebrew word for shalom, Hebrew word shalom, we translate it peace, and that's an accurate translation. But our word peace is kind of an insufficient term, because for us, peace is the negation of irritation or war or something, you know. It's just a negative term. Peaceful is what I'm not having. but the shalom is actually a picture almost of wholeness, of full flourishing life. And we can describe, although the Bible doesn't use that term for the creation, we can picture it as that fullness of life, complete harmony, working with one another, the bees pollinating the plants and the plants feeding the birds and, you know, all these things going on. You can see the whole thing working together, and then sin happened. And the shalom was broken. And then death-dealing things. Jeb and I were talking some time back. It must not have been at least bacteria or germs that can cause death existing then. You know, there was no death before sin. Death came by sin. There must not have been hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, volcanoes blowing up villages or dumping hot ash on them. These things couldn't have happened because there was no death. sin came and all of that, you know, thorns and thistles. But then death-dealing things were loosed on the world. Decay became the operating principle of nature. Everything now is running down. Everything is falling apart. And so that's what sin did. The question then we need to ask is, what can put it all right? If we have led our person to see that they have chosen a God less worthy than the true God, the question is, what can we do to put it all back together? When a person comes to the place in their life where they admit that they are not the person that they know they should be, they most often say, well, then I've just got to try it. I've got to change something. I've got to turn over a new leaf. Or I've got to try harder, like that young man at the Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I need to believe in myself more. I need to try harder. But this must lead to a spiritual dead end. When anything other than God is the center and identity of our life, we give effort, even then, we give effort to the God-centered morality. But that's not part of our life. We recognize morality, but as we were talking about earlier, if your God is science and evolution, you ought to be for violence against the weak. That's the struggle of evolution, the survival of the fittest. You ought to say, down with the poor. Close the hospitals except for, you know, really powerful people who broke an arm or something. Yet you have to give lip service to God-centered morality. It's in your heart. But that's been borrowed from a different identity. You are paying for the morality of somebody else's identity out of your religious identity with whatever it is you've chosen as your God. C.S. Lewis said that this is like the poor man who pays taxes hoping there's enough left over for him to live on. Anybody identify with that? And the thing is that, you know, you come to the place where you recognize that you need to do these moral things. You need to be compassionate to these things, but you don't know why. And so you have to expend it without it being part of your central identity. So can I do these moral things and have enough left of me to honor that thing which is the center of my life? C.S. Lewis then contrasts this to Christianity. He says, the Christian way is different. Christ says, give me all. I don't want just this much of your time and this much of your money and this much of your work so that your natural self can have the rest. I want you, not your things. I have come not to torture your natural self. I will give you a new self instead. Hand over the whole natural self, all the desires. Not just the ones you think wicked, but the ones that you think innocent. The whole outfit. I will give you a new self instead. In his book, Is Christianity Hard or Easy? He counseled that giving up yourself was very hard. But it is far easier, he says, than what we are all trying to do instead. For what we are trying to do is remain what we call ourselves, our personal happiness centered on money or pleasure or ambition, and hoping despite this to behave honestly and chastely and humbly. And that is exactly what Christ warned us you cannot do. If I am a grass field, all the cutting will keep the grass less, but it won't produce wheat. If I want wheat, I must be plowed up and re-sown. And that's what Christ wants of us. So every person who is honest with himself must sense that there is, as Augustine said, a part of the heart that cannot be filled properly with anything but God. Jesus Christ formed you, and nothing in the world can satisfy you as much as him. Nothing. Even if you are successful in any number of life events, they cannot give you the significance, the security, and the affirmation that he can. You must live for something. That will become the Lord of your life. The Lord of your life. Jesus is the only Lord who can fulfill you completely. If you fail him, he will forgive you. In fact, he already knows that you can fail him and that you will fail him many times. He's already made provision for your forgiveness and reinstatement, 1 John 1:9. If we confess our sins, so we must have sins to confess, right? He is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. So I think that this will be a way of thinking that will help you deal with people that have chosen their way to honor something, to get their sense of self-worth, not from God, but from something else. And if you have not chosen God, you have chosen something else. All right, our time is up. Any comments or questions before we close? Anything to add? All right, let's stand, stretch, and have a word of prayer.